absolutely delightful to be back with her. And he has often said to me, it's an arduous ride all the way from Brighton up the M23 to the M25 and all the way across down here. I don't find it arduous because I know I'm coming to a pleasant place with beautiful people. And you are. I was bringing you greetings from my wife and from Sasha and Vera that you pray for. I'm going to visit them in Norway in 2 weeks' time. Just spend time with them, encouraging them and visiting some of the key places where the refugees are looked after. Many, many places we sneak them into. The whole situation that Sasha has been given an absolute privilege because he is the only one in the whole of Norway, I believe, who speaks Russian, Yiddish, Hebrew, he speaks English, he speaks the Norwegian language quite thoroughly. And I mean, with all those assets, various politicians and refugee depots are calling him all the time to mediate. Of course, they don't pay him for it, but it's given him a phenomenal status to have invitations to preach the gospel that would have been closed had we not been there to look after refugees. It was brilliant. I'm going to tell you the stories a little later on. And Sasha sends it up. He said, this is the sweetest church in all England. That's not biased, for example. I'm going to share an encouragement with you from the life of Simon Peter. And he's a man that I'm encouraged by because he was, I guess I was much like that at school in South Africa. And in most of my early Christian years, before I got a little bit of wisdom, and let me read to you the verses from Luke 5. They tell a brilliant story of Simon's first contact with Jesus. So it was, as the multitude pressed around Jesus to hear the word of God, that he stood by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats standing by the lake. But the fishermen had gone from them, and they were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land, and he sat down and taught the multitude from the boat. When he'd stopped speaking, he said to Simon, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. But Simon answered and said, Master, we've toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I'll let down the net. That's important. At your word. At your word. Obedience or disobedience. The results depend on that. And when they had done this, they caught a great number of fish that their net was breaking. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, depart from me, Lord. And in other words, I can't handle this. For I am a sinful man. For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, and who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, don't be afraid. From now on you will catch men. So when they brought their boats to land, they forsook all and followed him. Now I'm going to put that into some casual talk, as it would have been in that day, where we have Jesus, first of all, making contact. That's how he comes to us. He makes contact in a very simple, natural way. He says to Simon, can I borrow your boat? And I can imagine Simon summing it up, looking at his meager cash, caught nothing, and he's got debtors to pay. And Jesus making this instruction. In fact, Jesus just preached from the boat. That's pretty good preaching. He's never heard stuff like that. There was no great demand. Simon wasn't using his boat. Jesus didn't want to sail all the way around the world or sail all the way around the Sea of Galilee, just a few meters out. No risk involved, won't push up the insurance premiums. Simple, natural thing that Jesus is asking. Wasn't that way when Jesus came to you? Simple, natural thing. It was with me. As I read this, is in the gentleness and humanity of Jesus. He's not pushing. Now, some of you have heard my simple testimony. When I was 17, I quit boxing because my mother was fearful that I was going to meet a boxer like my father, who was South Africa's light heavyweight champion. And I boxed as a welterweight. And I was having to fight middleweights who are much heavier and heavier punches than me. And my mother thought I'd get my brain scrambled. One Sunday morning, I was down at the local pool with my father and my sister, just enjoying the early morning swim. And my dad was talking to a grey-haired old man. I thought he was old. I'm actually beyond that age now. And I got out of the pool. I just swam 400 metres rather quickly. And this man said to me, "David Smith, I want you to dive back in the pool and swim 100 metres as fast as you can." And I nearly said, "But I've done my swimming for the day." But my dad glared at me and I responded. I said, "Okay." I dived in, I swam 100 metres. Not too fast, I didn't blow a valve. I got out of the pool and the man said, "I've been a friend of your father's a long time. In fact, we swam, played water polo, were lifesavers together on a national level." He said, "I want you to come and swim in my squad." And he walked away. And I said to my dad, "Who was that?" He says, "That's the South African Olympic swimming coach." Oh. Well, I swam 10,000 meters a day for a year, including Sundays. 5,000 in the morning, 5,000 in the evening, followed by 10 100-meter sprints. And finally, towards the end of the year, it got through to me, "I'm doing this for no money." I mean, there were no sponsors in those days. Crazy. You had to have money and riches in your family or your friends to get to the Olympics. I was selected to go to the Olympics in 1960. But I never got there because I didn't have the money. So, not a problem. I quit that and became an accountant instead and earned some money. But that, one of my training sessions one evening was a young man from Rhodesia, from Salisbury, now Harare, who had come down to hear his family. His name was Trevor. And I met him through two boys that knew Trevor that were part of my high school first rugby team that I played in. And they told me about Trevor. They said, "He's a little weird because he's suffering from bilharzia. Only the Rhodesians and South Africans here would know what bilharzia is. It's a disease that is picked up from a parasite that grows and lives in slow-moving streams. And if you swim in those streams, it attaches itself to your skin, burrows through your skin, and gets into the bloodstream and eats away the lining of your bladder. And it's painful. I've never had it, but Trevor had it." And the treatment in those days was worse than the sickness. He never complained. I never heard him complain. He gave me his best in pushing me and swimming. And I found he had a girlfriend that was giving him a really hard time. And I said to him, "Why don't you just ditch her, Dapper? He doesn't want to hurt her feelings." And then this man would go out of his way to help people in need. And I thought, what? He was 16, I was 17. I thought, what planet does he come from? That doesn't have, I mean, he's not a teenager. You know, he's abnormal. And in one of our training sessions, we were halfway through the 10 100 meter sprints, gasping for breath, watching the clock tick around. And I turned to him and I said, "Trevor, I want to know what you've got that makes you so different. I said, I think you're weird, but what have you got that helps you to overcome all your adversities and still reach out to people in kindness?" And he was gasping for breath as well. He said, "David, I have a relationship with Jesus, don't you?" What? And the bus I went to, we had to dive in the pool. I never had a chance to have another conversation with him in the next couple of months. This was burrowing into my brain, a relationship with Jesus. I knew who Jesus was, the Savior of all mankind, the head of the church. But how do you have a relationship with someone so remote? And so just in the ministry, I was so remote. And I was a churchgoer, sort of. Well, through a girl I was dating at that time, I got an invitation to the garden party in the neighboring suburb where Trevor's parents and two sisters were coming down from Rhodesia to live in Durban. And nobody told me that Trevor's father was going to be the minister of the little Pentecostal church in my home suburb of Woodlands, Montclair. And I just was interested in meeting Earl Davies, Trevor's father, because he was a Rhodesian boxer and rugby player, very fast right wing on the Rhodesian rugby team. And at the garden party, I walked up to him and I said, "Good day, sir, my name is David Smithers." And he said, "Oh, well, I'm Earl Davies. Do you have a relationship with Jesus, David?" Oh, straight out like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel cornered, I was rather surprised. Second time I'd heard that in 2 months. And I said to him, "Sir, is that what Trevor's got?" He said, "Yes." I said, "I want it." No argument. In fact, he was surprised. He heard I was quite an intelligent fellow. I don't know where he got that from. But he didn't deny me. I wanted to know. So briefly explain. Well, there's a big wall of sin standing between you and God. You're one side, on the way to hell. He put all the nuts and bolts together. He said, on the other side, God is reaching out to you. And Jesus has already paid the price to tear down that barrier, that wall of sin. He wants to take your hand and the Father's hand and bring you together into an eternal relationship with you as his child. And I said, you know, I don't think I want it. He didn't pressurize me. He said, right, you don't think about it. And a couple of months later, I was laying some concrete with my young girlfriend's father, and you know, I had a decent build in those days of bodybuilding and swimming and rugby and played soccer for football for a good team as well. But I was covered with cement dust. She came out in the afternoon and said, "David, you coming to church with me tonight?" That was the last thing on my thoughts. And her father said, "No excuses. You can wear my clothing, go and have a quick shower and put my shoes on." I fitted his clothing, but his shoes were 3 sizes smaller than my feet. I sat in that very short 45-minute church service on a Sunday evening, squirming. And when Earl finished his simple little message, he said, "Anyone want to see Jesus?" I jumped to my feet. I said, "Yes, sir." I went, well, he was so surprised. Normally he had to appeal. But I was ready for it. Took me to the little back classroom. Gawky kids drawings around the wall, sitting on a chair, 8 inches off the floor. I thought, I'm glad my sporting friends can't see me now, but I'm absolutely idiot. Knelt on the floor with him, inviting Jesus into my life. And that changed history. Trevor was standing at the church door. We were going out for a cup of coffee before I went home, finished some university assignments for the next day. And I said to him, "Trevor, well, where do we go from here? So I've got Jesus in my heart, what do I do?" He said, "Well, look, I'm working that out as well. He'd only known him for about 2-3 years. And he said, "Look, we're friends. We only saw each other on weekends because I was going to work at the university and he was at technical college about 2 years ahead of me. Anyway, he said, look, I started walking with Jesus. Why don't we walk together?" That was the best thing anyone could have done for me, to disciple me into the rest of walking with Jesus. We went to the beaches on weekends, led lifesavers to the Lord, led service to the Lord. I watched him, copied him, and Earl mentored me as a soul winner. And I think there was only one other guy in the church, other than Trevor and me, who received from Earl that anointing, as well as the ability to just negotiate with people. And that started this wonderful bit, a simple, gentle approach, like Jesus. Negotiating with Simon Peter. Well, it was followed by a challenge, because when they came out of water, Jesus made a statement, summing up, you prepare to live all this and follow me. And he walked, he didn't wait for a reply, he walked down the beach. And Simon Peter thought, well, I've seen a miracle today, let's follow him and see what happens. Simon Peter, Andrew, James and John, the first disciples. That's the challenge that, you know, that always comes our way. And I'm finding that challenge doesn't stop. Because God wants to take us higher and further and to make a greater impact. And I am surprised. I am utterly shocked and surprised at some of the opportunities I have today. How did I get there? How did I do that? Well, it was one step at a time. Now, what I come to the statement that I'm asking myself, am I ready, as I get older, to do anything he wants, even if it takes me out of my comfort zone? And 10 years ago, as I got into my 70s, I said, right, Lord, let's do it. Wow. I used to hear people sharing testimonies in that little full gospel church in Durban. They'd get up on a Sunday morning, there was always testimony time, 3 or 4 people, and the pastor was very polite in cutting off the garrulous people who wanted to take over. They couldn't stop talking. But they were interesting. And what disturbed me were people saying, you know, God told me, God said to me, I heard this from God. And I thought, well, these are ordinary people. They must be very special that God talks to them audibly. And I went to God with an old lady one day, and I said, tell me, how often do you hear God's voice like that? Look, you, by your testimonies, you're hearing him every day. Oh, no, it's not an audible voice. It's an impression I get. I said, why did you say that? I'm sure others are confused as I am. You've got a telephone line in your head from God that you hear from him every day. I was going to ask how you pick up that telephone. Well, I got to the Lord that night. I had to finish getting to bed before 11 because I had to get up at 6, be ready at 7 to go into the city with my dad. I was working as an auditor and then going to university at night. And as I went to sleep, I said, Lord, I would really like to hear from you. I'm not just curious. If you know I can do something, and I'm being lazy about it, how about a chat? And I went to sleep. And I woke up suddenly at 2 a.m. I never woke up suddenly at that time. I had to struggle to get up at 6. My turn in the bathroom, having a quick shave to get ready for breakfast, and enter the car at 7 a.m. Well, 2 a.m., and I turned right over in my bed and I said, what's this? And I felt a compulsion to go to the other side of the house, where, away from the bedrooms, away from the kitchen where my mom had a little lodge. And I tiptoed through to the dining room, opened the window, and there was just a Durban gale blowing outside. And so I'm telling you that because those are the noises I needed to hear. I knelt down on the carpet and I prayed and I just said to the Lord, well, here I am. I don't know why I'm awake so early, but here I am. And I muttered a little prayer that I had in my head and I fell silent for about 3 or 4 minutes. And I felt, I heard a door handle open and a voice spoke through the darkness. And I don't know where it came from. And it was saying stuff to me that I needed to hear. I'm not going to go into detail, but it was in response to my question, how do you hear from God? How do you respond to it? And where does faith come from in all of this? And it lasted about 2 minutes. That was my mind calculating it. And I wasn't dreaming it, because I still hear the booms and I still hear my mom's dogs squawking in the kitchen. And then it was like somebody turned the radio off and the voice faded and gone. And I'm out there another 20 minutes trying to work this out. Shrugged my shoulders. I said, well, if that was God, thank you. Or if he sent an angel, thank you. Well, I woke up at 6, nice and fresh. Was ready to go into the city. Now, I had a little personal activity every morning. I'd go and sit in Medwood Garden, down West Street, across the road from the City Hall in Durban. And I would go and sit there and read my Bible and have a little devotional time. As I came to open the gates of those gardens, I felt an arm across my chest, stopping me from going in. I thought, this is weird. What's happening to me? And I pushed again. And I had a little voice say in my head, not this morning. And I thought, how dare you? This is my devotional time. Turn left, walk down from the post office, cross over Gardner Street, and walk down the street. What? But that's a long route to the office. I knew a shortcut. So I thought, well, I was amused now. I had about 30 minutes. That was my devotional time. Gone now. So I walked down the street and turned left into this arcade. I walked down the arcade, looking at shop windows, and got out into Smith Street, turned right into Smith Street. Okay, walked down the street, greeted a couple of guys, cleaners coming out of the businesses ready for the day, and I got to Field Street, cross over. And this voice prompted me again, no, turn, walk across Field Street. All this had taken about 20 minutes. And I could have done it in less than 5. Oh, a bit of exercise. I got to the other corner of Field Street and Smith Street, and I turned left to go to the office block that I worked in. It was the door just further up. And I had passed a little alcove into the chemist shop. And there was a man standing behind a newspaper. And I thought, that's odd. Now I've got a pretty perceptive sight. I saw the newspaper was upside down, so he wasn't reading it. And I got this thought in my head. Go to say to him that God loves you and he has a solution for your problem. Okay. And I thought, well, by the legs, he's pretty strong. And I reckon I could run faster than him and takes a swing at me. Tapped on the newspaper. Down he came. To reveal the haggard face of a man probably 30 years of age. He'd been crying. And I said to him, sir, look, I'm sorry to disturb you, but I believe I have a message for you, and it comes from God. He said he loves you, and he has a solution for your problem. And he burst into tears, dropped the newspaper, put his head on my shoulder, and just sobbed. I said, well, what's up, man? What's up? He said, look, that has to be from God. Because I've been standing here for 5 minutes. I would have missed him if I had gone straight to the office. God took me on a walk around the city so that man could get to that spot. He said, I messed up my marriage, messed up my business, and today, he said, I work on the 13th floor of that building across the road. I was planning to jump out the window at lunchtime and kill myself. And I just went cold. If I had insisted on doing my thing and going to the office one way, I would have missed it. That man would have died. Cut the story short, I led into Jesus once. Gave him a little four-hour tract I had in my pocket. And I said, what's your telephone number? Gave it to me. I said, I'm going to call you after lunch today, make sure you didn't jump. I called him and he said, no need for me to jump anymore. I've already had starting a change of circumstances in the business. And he said, I haven't told my wife yet. I'm going home tonight. I kept in touch with that man for about 4 or 5 minutes. God took him out of trouble. into the care room, and I learned how to listen to God's voice. And I'll tell you what, that has been a phenomenal, and I never want to lose that ability, because I've heard people say, God used to speak to me like that, but I lost it. I said, how do you listen? I didn't want to listen to him. I didn't want to obey. And I said, can you? I hope thousands haven't perished and gone to hell because you disobeyed. Wow. Look, I've made an idiot of myself sometimes when I thought I've heard from God, and I haven't. But nevertheless, I passed the gospel on to someone, and nothing seemed to come of it. But I would say the higher percentage of running in the 90s of being in the right place at the right time have proved that it was the right thing to do. Now, I'll tell you another little story before I'm going to show you some slides. When I was a chaplain and a counselor, some of you know that I'm a crisis chaplain for the Olympics and the Paralympics. I've done four. And the Rugby World Cup and the Commonwealth Games. And believe me, there are athletes who need a kick in the backside. They are highly temperamental. And when they fail, they get suicidal. And some of these guys deserve the circumstances that have come against them, because they sneak around. They don't look at anyone and think that's what they do. There are some of them that have come to me, I can't mention names, or the Olympics, have come to me torn to pieces, because they've been bad boys, and their wives have served them with divorce papers at the Olympics. That's pretty smart. And that's demoralized them, and they become suicidal. And I get the quote-unquote privilege of talking to these guys, normally when they're blind drunk, and at 2 in the morning, called by their coaches and managers. And I've got, depending on the culture, I've got to be brutal. The Slavic people and the African people are tough cultures, and you've got to come at them head on. British people, you've got to be gentle, but still accurate. You see what I mean? And I had an encounter like that in Athens. And I was tired, worn out one morning when I came down from a crummy little hotel I had to stay in. And I was walking across the quadrangle, across a little back road in the Plaka Square in Athens, to have a quick breakfast, because the hotel was so cheap, didn't have breakfast. I gave a little ticket to go to a cafe for a free breakfast. But I had to be at the train station in 20 minutes. If I missed that train, I missed the bus connection to the Olympic Village, which was halfway between Athens and Corinth. And I didn't want to miss that. So I came out of the doorway, down steps out of the hotel, and I tripped over an old man pushing a shopping cart with all his belongings in. I said, oh, I'm sorry. And I picked up some stuff and put them in the shopping cart. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, sir. What's your name? He said, Nicolaus. And he spoke with an American accent. He was an American Greek. And I said to him, are you all right, sir? He was about 80 years old. And very despondent and worn out. He'd been sleeping on the streets. I said, look, I'm in a hurry, but if you need food, here's my breakfast ticket, which he gladly took at the cafe across the road. I thought, well, I can skip breakfast, I can have some yogurt, Greek yogurt at the Olympic Village. And he told me a tragic story. He said, I've retired from business, I'm an inventor, and I'm just brilliant with making security devices. And the Olympic Committee called me and negotiated a contract with me to create a special security device that would use in every security gate in the whole of the Olympics. And then, when I put my pension fund into that, spent all I had, they called me and said, forget it, we've got it cheaper. He said, I got a call from Corinth, from another company who knew they'd made a mistake, and said, listen, we want to have a look at your product. Please come in. We're not no promise. He said, I'm going to see if I can salvage the wreck that I have. I felt so sorry for this guy. I said, look, I know the train fare to Corinth is €50 in return. Here's €50. And I made him go around him. He caught my arm. And he said to me, "Sir, why are you doing this for me?" He said, "I've never seen such kindness." He said, I said to him, "Look, I'm a child of God. And I believe it's my duty to help someone like you. I'm investing in some long-term investment here, giving to you." And he said to me, "Are you a minister or a missionary?" I said, "Well, I suppose, yes, you could call me that. But here I'm a Christian counselor at the Olympics." And he said, "Do you have a message for me?" Now, I've got 2 minutes, 2 minutes left, and I've got to run to the station. So I quickly told him the story of the shepherd leaving 99 sheep in the sheepfold and looking for one lost sheep. And I said, "Sir, your time of rescue is coming. God bless you." Put away and he grabbed my shirt sleeve. He said, "Please, sir, I'd like to be found now." Broke my heart. I forgot about the Olympic Village. I thought I could make some excuse. If I tell the manager of the Olympic Village why I was late, well, too late. And I knelt on the flagstones with this old man, led him to Jesus. He was in tears and crying. I had one of my little Following Jesus books with me. I gave them to him. And I said, "Listen, God bless you. My phone number's on the back. Give me a call and let me know how it goes." Actually, I got a call about a month later. He said, "The circumstances have changed. Those guys in Corinth bought my invention." That was what I expected, but I'm out of the gutter now. He says, "Thank you for helping me to become one of Jesus' sheep." I mean, just learning to listen to God's voice like that. Amazing. Now, I'm going to run through quick slides, just for a couple of minutes, because where's the clicker?
That button's forward.
Looks like a cigarette lighter. So that's the top one.
The middle one.
The middle one.
Why? Okay.
Now, this of course was the House of Hope in 2012 when I met Peter Amiyanov. He'd been led to the Lord by Vitaly Maximuk, a Latvian man that I had trained in evangelism 10 years before in Latvia. How God connects these relationships up. Vitaly and Nadezhda's wife, Nadia, had come to Novosibirsk, that's Western Siberia, south of Moscow, led so many people to the Lord, they had to have 6 churches go. And Peter offered to go to Odessa, the Odessa province, south of the city of Odessa, to buy a little farmhouse, 2-story farmhouse that was absolutely rubbish, and start a center for homeless kids living in the drains and the sewers under the city that I had been reaching, together with another manager at that time, he had gone from me, but for about 10 years. And I thought, this is a brilliant idea, having an independent charity with a center like this that can't be closed down. Well, orphans evicted from boarding schools during the COVID period were collected. They needed foodstuffs. All of a sudden, my budget began to step up. These were taken to the poor villages in the COVID period, and these kids that were in the House of Hope, that was what shift number one, I was teaching them how to lead people to the Lord so that they knew they were saved and they could lead others to the Lord like they were doing. And they cottoned onto this quickly. Well, they could barely speak their own language, and they would go out on 5 days a week. They eventually accomplished 485 villages in 2 years. And they led 12,000 people to Jesus. Now, how's that for a harvest? Now, I'm being conservative with that. I just added the statistics up. And some of the figures I couldn't read, because when a person used to writing the Russian language writes figures, they get a bit of scare. And, you know, these are kids that knew nothing, no church protocol. All they knew was they were saved, and they knew how to bring others to the Lord and give them the assurance. 12,000, and I wasn't even there for those 2 years. And I couldn't claim any glory for that. And they didn't either. Well, they went out, they brought in kids in the countryside. That young man, on the right-hand side, he has just passed his A-level examinations in Germany in a language he never grew up with. And I'm so proud of these kids. He got up to make a speech at his graduation day, and he spoke about Jesus. And the teenager, this guy, come from Ukraine a year ago, speaking our language, speaking German, and passing his exams. Man, you know, I'm so proud of these kids. They are lined up for great jobs. And Peter collected the kids, brought them. Of course, we knew the house of hope had to be increased. And I thought maybe two stories above ground, build two more on top. They went into making two bomb-proof basements. I thought, why extra money into bomb-proof? This is the accountant thinking. They said, anything can happen in this country. We're going to make two bomb-proof basements. Six stories. Well, I mean, it looks like a hotel. That's cheap stuff. They have the world's biggest open-air market run by South Koreans. And stuff can be bought cheap there. I shop there often. And there was the House of Hope complete in January 2022. And this stupid war broke out 1 month later. Well, the House of Hope has been a refuge for so many people. The kids were sleeping in the bomb-proof basements. And then they made a decision when it came close to be bombed. A frigate came from Crimea, a Russian frigate, and was aiming sights at the military base, which is 1 mile further inland from this big building. And they were worried that the shells were going to hit the orphan building before it hit the military base. And they prayed and prayed and prayed, Lord, please drive them away. Now, it was wintertime. It's freezing cold there, drops lower temperature than here, but it never snows at the coast. It's just something with the coastline of the Black Sea. Well, suddenly a snowstorm came out of the blue sky with a wind that caused huge waves that nearly turned the frigate over. They had to stop aiming their sights and go rush back to the Crimea. And when the kids got the news, they jumped up and down. We prayed and God chased them away. They got some stories to tell.
Yeah.
But then they wanted to be moved out. So Sasha and I gave Peter the okay to take them out. Now, I'm not showing you all the slides. It was taking people out. We were donated by two Australian people, Australian widows, money to buy two 26-seater Mercedes buses. All right, cheap price in Ukraine. I mean, many pounds going in there becomes a fortune in Ukraine. And then Odessa started getting hit. Because what Putin wants is Odessa and Kiev. And he wants the whole of the coastline down to Moldova, where he owns a plant called Transnistria. And I don't think he's going to be happy until he gets that coastline. Well, Odessa got hit. There were casualties. And in that barrage, we lost one of our best drivers. I still miss him today. Another group out. And then, of course, Vitaly and the other driver would bring stuff in. We'd buy stuff in Eastern Germany or in Moldova and bring it back in. And, of course, the border guards got the first choice of medicine. These are border guards that I just remember in 2014-2016, the Russian rebel army broke into the nation and they shot the Malaysian airliner out of the sky. They got under control. I was then conscripted from ministering to the military in Latvia to the military in Ukraine. I was taken around by the military escort, preaching to the soldiers, and some of those border guards remembered me. I mean, many of those soldiers have been killed. They were just the privilege of being authorized by the Orthodox Archbishop of Ukraine. He gave me such a big hug, about my height. He looked like Willie Nelson. You know, better looker than Willie Nelson with the American Country and Western Center. Anyway, the ministry goes on. The House of Hope kids in Düsseldorf, and again, Odessa has been bombed. And We're taking out more people all the time. Those big buses, what we've done is kept them in Moldova because they're too big a target. The drones focus on them. They've anchored on those drone missiles that missed us. We use smaller vans to go through the forest roads where there are no mines. Do you know that Ukraine is the most mined country in the world? More than Vietnam and Cambodia. And it's going to take 20 years to clean that country up. Well, power stations were knocked out, devastation, and those are chemical warfare in chemical pods in eastern Ukraine that Russia has control of. Power stations were hit, and of course, when they poisoned the lakes in the area, Putin's drones poisoned all the lakes. People were drinking water from the lakes and dying. We found through a kitchen leak that builders came to repair, we had an artesian well under the house of land. Where fresh water, don't know where it comes from, fresh water is drawn out for the people to come in. And one fella got on a bicycle and rode 100 kilometers, 60 miles, to come down and buy. We had it water free, we put it in the back of the van and took him home. He said, we're going to bring the water up to your villages. And but we need smaller to move the people out quicker on the forest roads. A truck got destroyed by a landmine close to the House of Hope. That was a terrible devastation. But those were our old vans perishing. And but now what's happening, I'm finishing on this. What's happening in Norway is an unprecedented thing. Norway is a straight up and down, stiff and starchy country. And not the place you'd expect spiritual revival to break out. But that's through Sasha and Vera's ministry there and their local team that is that we have to fund. Because they're working their nuts off day and night, and they have no chance to go and work. And it's stretching us to the limit. So I'm asking you for prayers for that. But what has happened? In Bible study groups, unsaved people are coming because they enjoy the fellowship, interaction, and the food.
Yeah.
And then when they meet in a little community hall, unsaved people walking past come in. And then the crowd will get together on one of the fields, and just out in the field in the sun, and they start singing. They put up tables with food, and people walking their dogs would come up. That's really interesting. What if, well, we're refugees from Ukraine. We're young people who've escaped the Russian attacks. Come and join us. And the people come along, and these kids are leading the Norwegian people to Jesus. And there's been a spiritual awakening right across that upper belt, from Oslo to Trondheim on the west coast. And it's just been marvelous. The pressure says it happens every time we get together. He said, that's why I ask you for money for food orders. Well, I'm asking for your prayers for this. Because where this is going is maybe it's the turning point for that nation. It's not part of the EU. It's like Britain came out of the EU. They're free of EU policies. And it looks like God has chosen a spiritual awakening to take place there. It's something to really to pray about. Now, I'm finished now. I'd like to pray for you. But let me just say, I've got some stuff here on the counter, which, this is a little book called Nadia, written and illustrated by Isabel Newton. She's a 12-year-old girl living in Perth in Western Australia. Her parents and her grandparents were friends of mine. Grandparents were slightly younger than me. And they leave my newsletters around. Incidentally, there's my latest newsletter on the table. Please help yourself in praying for the needs I mentioned there. And by the way, some of you might not have got my commemorative pen that I put out last time. Please come and take one. I found some spare ones in my bag. And this little book, Nadia, is written about a typical little Ukrainian girl that got into Isabel Newton's head. And she wrote the story and won a prominent book prize as a result. She had a lot of money for it. And she sent me a whole batch. She said, give these to people who'd like to hear what pre-teenagers are feeling like having to leave their country. It's very touching. And I hope it's a blessing to you. Well, Philip, I thank you for listening to me. I thank you for your friendship. And I thank you for the gifts that this church sends that go straight into the needs in Ukraine. We've got a way of getting money in without offending the banking system. It's very innocent, dirty, and it's legal. But the money goes to support the refugees as well, which Western Germany and Norway have become very tight with their refugee funds. And they'd be sick and dying without that. So you've been a big help. I wonder if you'd stand with me, please. I'm going to pray a very special prayer for you. Father, I thank you for these special people. Lord, they've sown seeds in abundance.
Yeah.
Especially into this great need. I'm asking you to honor that and bless them and prosper them in every way where they have lack. Fill up that lack and cause it to overflow. That they can serve you in bigger ways and better ways than they never thought of before. Lord, especially in the area of their health and their healing, minister to them by your life-giving spirit and restore their bodies to function that will be a phenomenal talking point in this region where people will come up and say, what's changed you? An opportunity to bring those people to Christ.
Yes.
Lord, thank you for these precious people. In Jesus' name.
Thank you.